today, another massive bailout for the jobs market as COVID-19 causes the worst economic downturn in centuries.
You have to go back to the first decade of the 18th century to find something as bad as what's happened to the economy in the last 2 or 3 months. You have to go back to when Queen Anne was on the throne, when the Duke of Marlborough was bombing around Europe, beating up the French in various battles. That's what we're comparing the crash of 2020 to. It's something which, in historic terms, we haven't seen for more than three centuries.
It's in that context that Rishi Sunak found himself as Chancellor of the Exchequer, shutting down large parts of the economy and then paying the salaries of millions of people who would have otherwise lost their livelihoods. Yesterday, Sunak went further than expected to extend the furlough scheme until October.
We believe in the dignity of work, and we are doing everything we can to protect people currently unable to work. This scheme has been a world-leading economic intervention, supporting livelihoods and protecting futures.
It seems almost unbelievable that the Conservative Party would be overseeing the biggest state intervention in the jobs market that there has ever been. But coronavirus has changed everything. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does the worst economic crisis in 300 years mean for Britain? Larry Elliott, economics editor at The Guardian. It seems almost unbelievable that we have to go back three centuries to find a time when the economy saw a downturn as bad as this one. What year are you talking about?
1709, I think, was the last year which was comparable. It's kind of difficult to be quite precise because the economic data was even dodgier then than it is now. The thing about that sort of era was that the economy was at the mercy of nature. It was all about the harvest and whether you had cold weather or rainy weather. And I think in 1709 was something known as the Great Frost, where it was one of the many times that the Thames froze over. You had people selling from market stalls on the River Thames. It was a really cold, hard year, I think, that probably the crops failed. But no one is absolutely certain. But 1709 was a fall in the economy of around 14%, which is what the Bank of England is projecting for this year.
The Bank of England today is sketching out that the pandemic and the shutdown have plunged the UK economy into the sharpest downturn in history, a far worse start to a recession than the financial crisis over a decade ago, but with the hope of a rapid rebound.
So we have to go back beyond a financial crash, beyond two world wars, beyond many other terrible diseases to get to the Great Frost. And that, you think, is the most comparable disaster to hit the UK to coronavirus?
Yeah, that's the most recent comparable year. Generally speaking, recessions in the past 200 years have normally been associated either with the aftermaths of major conflicts, of wars, or more recently when inflation has got out of control or there's been some wild speculative boom that's come to an end. There have been, I think, four big recessions in the post-war era before this one, and the worst of those was in 2008-09 when the economy contracted from a peak to a trough by about 6% of national output, 6% of GDP. This time we're going to contract by around 25% of GDP, maybe 30% of GDP in just two quarters, which goes to show just how huge the effect of this lockdown will be.
Wow. That is unbelievable.
No, it is unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I've been a financial journalist for a long, long time, and I thought in 2008-09 I'd probably seen everything, but this is just something completely different. It's this kind of defining moment of our lifetimes, I think, as journalists. It's completely catastrophic.
And I think within that, even the term recession and the growth figures on which that term is based can be quite intangible. In your job, you look at economic indicators to understand what is going on. Tell me which ones are key right now and what's happened to them.
Well, you can look at things like the number of people who have been put on the government's furlough scheme,
which pays 80% of an employee's salary up to a maximum of £2,500 a month, is now supporting more than 7 million workers.
And another example is the number of new cars sold to private buyers. So in April last year, I think there was something like 65, 66,000 cars sold to private buyers going into car showrooms and buying a new car. This April, there were fewer than 1,000 cars sold to private buyers. So there's been a fall of 99% in the number of new cars.
The vehicle used to roll off the line here every 90 seconds. Now car sales have crashed to their lowest level since 1946.
You can just get a glimpse of how serious that is. I mean, everything pretty much has been shut down.
That's why we've seen that dire projection from the Bank of England. They do also suggest that we could bounce back quite quickly, a V-shaped recession. But that's based on assumptions, including a fairly short lockdown without a second peak, and the idea that in the middle of all of this, we get a Brexit breakthrough and have a free trade deal in place with the EU by the end of the year. I know other forecasters and you think that this could be more of what's called an L-shaped recession, where the drop is followed by a flat line for much longer. Why is that?
It's quite easy to put an economy into lockdown, but as we're finding out, it's much more difficult to get it out of lockdown. It happens very, very slowly and in stages.
Because although we have a plan, it is a conditional plan. And since our priority is to protect the public and save lives, we cannot move forward unless we satisfy the five tests.
Even if there's no second phase to the epidemic, I don't think we're going to come out of this very, very quickly. The second point is, you know, consumers are vital here. And it's a question of how quickly people get the confidence back to go out and live their lives in the way that they were before this happened, i.e. sort of December, January time. So a lot of small businesses particularly operate on very small, very thin, wafer thin, in many cases, profit margins. And they just cannot afford to see a big drop in the numbers of people coming through the door. So I think that the real danger for the economy is probably what happens in the autumn. And I think that is the maximum period of danger for the economy.
You know, this is my life, right? This is my life. Since I came to this country, I built this for 22 years.
At the Sabla Dor Bakery in North London, Mohamed Lajasser is one of the many people Larry is talking about, grappling with the question of the future of his business as the COVID-19 crisis cripples sales. He settled in Britain in the 90s after civil war broke out in Algeria. Living in London, he missed the French flavours he grew up with and saw a business opportunity.
When I decided to open it, I couldn't find anything like this. You could find either bakery only or cafe only, but the combination of both was kind of like a new concept for England.
This was a time when there was just one Starbucks in the UK, not 1,000, and Mohamed's shop in Crouch End, North London, thrived. He opened a second branch in Muswell Hill.
This is a neighbourhood cafe. It's an extension to their house, an extension to their home. It's when they don't have a coffee with their family, they come and have a coffee here. It's really an extension to their home.
And after years of pouring himself into Sabla Dor, he's not ready to close.
It was a lot of sacrifices, ups and downs and everything. And after 22 years, I cannot imagine just going just like that.
Coronavirus hit business straight away, with the number of customers coming through the door starting to slow down in early March, even before the shutdown.
People were starting complaining about the tables, you know, this is too close to me, this is too close to me, and we were losing it. So we were, going down on a free fall, really, in March, that is.
Mohammed closed briefly and then was able to remain open under the rules. But the negative impact of the nationwide lockdown has still devastated his business.
We don't know what's happening. How long is going to be this way? Because you might have a little bit of cash flow. You might have, you know, you can survive. But what else? What is the future? I have a few people who've been working for a long time. It's not only my survival, it's their survival. You know, I could write a book of what's happening in these shops because I build it a brick by brick. We have been in crisis, 2008 and one before, a few of them, a downturn economic. And we have adapted to this situation. But this is a bit different, a lot different, actually.
And Larry, stories like the one we've just heard from Mohammed are being played out all over the country. That's why the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, took such massive action early on.
Today, I can announce that for the first time in our history, the government is going to step in and help to pay people's wages.
Clearly, the furlough scheme has helped businesses like Mohammed's to stay afloat, but just about, it's still a big struggle. Yesterday, we saw another huge announcement extending that job scheme at the same 80% level until October. These interventions are massive, aren't they?
Well, the steps taken by the government are colossal, but warranted, I think. I mean, I think there's been a massive increase in the size of the state as a result of this. If the state hadn't stepped in, the economy would have been completely wiped out. I mean, you know, the state really has taken over the labour market by subsidising 80% of wages up to £2,500 per month. I mean, that's a colossal intervention and very expensive. I mean, for every extra month that's kept in place, it costs something like £13 billion, I think, is the latest figure. So, you know, the government is spending on subsidising wages every month what it spends on the NHS. In peace times, it's kind of unusual for the government to spend more than, say, 4-5% of GDP and borrowing. In 2008-09, it went up to almost 11%. This time, it's going to go 15, 16, 17, 20% maybe. I mean, you know, depending on how long the government keeps these schemes in place, the size of the budget deficit is going to balloon. And that's something that worries the Chancellor deeply, you can tell.
You can certainly tell. And in fact, if the Conservative Party were in opposition and this was a Labour government doing this, they would be absolutely flabbergasted. They would be asking where that money was coming from. Instead, we have this situation where, unlike the previous Conservative government that oversaw the austerity years, Boris Johnson has been reluctant to even use that language. He calls it the A word.
The government has absolutely no intention of returning to the A word, which I won't quote. That is not going to be our approach. We don't think that that is
going
to be.
So when it comes to paying this off, will they be tempted to go back there, or is there an alternative?
When it's all over, I think it's inconceivable that the government will follow the same supposed remedy that George Osborne and David Cameron followed in 2010 onwards. I just don't think that is feasible politically, and is certainly not justified economically. I mean, what we know from previous experience is that if you withdraw the stimulus too soon, if you go for too much austerity too soon, you kill off the growth in the economy, you actually limit the bounce back, and you end up with a much higher budget deficit for longer than you're expecting. And that's the lesson of the last 10 years, that the government retrenched too soon, growth faltered, borrowing went up, and it took them much, much longer to get on top of the public finances than they expected.
One thing that is clear is that while Sunak clearly wanted to go ahead with these huge interventions, there are big worries about them in the Treasury.
We are potentially spending as much on the furlough scheme as we do on the NHS, for example. Now, clearly, that is not a sustainable situation.
I mean, we've heard the suggestion of people becoming addicted to the furlough scheme and the suggestion that they should be weaned off it. That language is attributed to government sources, but does it tell us something about how they see these measures?
from my sources, the language of last week where people talked about having to wean people off it and the addictive nature is not something that I've heard from Treasury ministers. It's coming from somewhere else in Whitehall. And I think the Treasury is certainly worried about the cost of the furlough scheme and all the other schemes, you know, including the schemes for the self-employed, none of which it wants to keep in place for too long. But that language is really unfortunate because the economy just hit a wall in late March. People didn't voluntarily decide that the bar they were working in or the shop they were working in was going to close, that they were going to just stay at home and tend the garden and play with the kids. They were forcibly told to stop working and go home. And they're not addicted to the furlough scheme. What the furlough scheme is doing in many cases is enabling them to pay the bills and keeping them from personal financial disasters.
Coming up, some silver linings. Keep listening. But first, we believe The Guardian's open journalism is incredibly important. It gives you facts, it searches for answers, and it always tries to give you hope, as we will be doing at the end of this episode, I promise. But right now, things are tough. Our advertising revenue and newspaper sales are falling faster than ever before, which means we need your support more than ever. Please, if you value what you're listening to and what you read on our website, then think about supporting us, as that will help sustain us and keep our journalism open during this crisis and beyond. Go to gu.com/support podcasts. Okay, everything you've told me so far is really quite depressing. We know that COVID-19 has been devastating for our country's health and that this lockdown has been devastating for our economy, especially people losing jobs. But I just want to ask you about silver linings. Firstly, in economic terms, who would have dreamt of such massive interventions from a Conservative government? Do you think this is a blip for them, or could it change the way they view the role of government? And if so, could it mean we start to see policy ideas that were previously unthinkable?
Oh, I think this changes things for good. I don't think we're going to go back to the sort of Thatcherite neoliberal dream world of some Tory backbenchers or some free market think tanks. I think this has changed the way in which Britain operates. The state has got a lot bigger and in ways that you would have thought inconceivable for a Conservative government. Who would have thought that the government would have been saying we are going to subsidise 80% of the wages of workers? Who would have thought that a Conservative government would have decided to effectively renationalise the railways? I mean, it has opened up a whole different vista for politics. And, you know, there are lots of interesting economic ideas that have been floating around for a long time, which all of a sudden are now being treated much more seriously. So there is something known as universal basic income, the idea that every person in the country should be given the same amount of money to live on.
Several MPs, opposition mostly, have signed a letter which they've sent to the Financial Times in which they basically said that they want some kind of universal income.
That's support. Been a very controversial policy, but suddenly there are people talking about it. There's something known as modern monetary theory, which is something that it means that the government doesn't necessarily have to worry about the size of its budget deficit because it can always get the Bank of England to print the money to pay for the spending that it's doing.
An unconventional economic theory is gaining some traction thanks to the policy teams of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders. It's called Modern Monetary Theory, MMT. Now, stay with me for this one.
There's not a great deal of difference between what's actually happening at the moment with the Bank of England buying every bond that the government floats and modern monetary theory. So that's the second one. I mean, there's, you know, the Green New Deal, of which I was a founder member.
You've probably heard a lot of talk about something called the Green New Deal from some Democrats in the US, the Labour Party in the UK, and school strikers around the world.
All of a sudden, people are starting to say, well, when this crisis is over, surely we need to be prepared for another, perhaps even bigger crisis climate change and using some of the massive government intervention in order to prepare the economy and to safeguard the economy against climate change and the climate emergency. So they're just three examples of different thinking. And I think that, you know, just generally, the idea that you just leave the economy to market forces has just been completely exploded by what's happened.
But when there isn't a crisis of this scale to contend with, even if Boris Johnson himself might flirt with some of the ideas that you're talking about, even if many of the Tory voters across the Red Wall who previously voted Labour might like to see those sort of interventions in the economy, ultimately, this is still a Conservative Party that is filled with people suspicious of government.
Yeah, the Tory Party is bankrolled by people who have a somewhat different view of the world from the one that currently exists. I mean, they are uncomfortable with a world in which the government takes a bigger share of the economy on its shoulders. They are uncomfortable with an idea where workers are being protected in the way that they currently are. And there will be, I'm sure, something of an ideological struggle inside the Conservative Party for the direction it takes, because quite a lot of what the Conservative Party are doing is what a Labour government would be doing if it was in power. I mean, whether the Conservative Party's hearts are in it or not, they are doing things that a left of centre Labour government would be doing if they were in control.
And finally, one thing that has totally changed is the way that we think about public sector workers. 5 years ago, we were talking about pay freezes and cuts, and the government felt at times like it was at war with doctors and nurses and teachers over pay. Now, we all stand outside our homes like clockwork every Thursday at 8 and clap, not just health workers, but teachers, delivery truck drivers, people working in supermarkets, bus drivers. Do you think that this has completely changed the way in which we value those type of jobs? And in practical terms, do you think that means people will be better paid at the end of it?
I think it certainly has changed the way in which we think about those groups of workers. I think that this period has been one where we've seen the reinvention of the working class. The idea that the working class had disappeared, that's gone by the board in this crisis, because Britain has been kept going by refuse collectors, postmen, bus drivers, delivery men, shelf stackers in supermarkets. I mean, those people who do those hands-on working class jobs have actually proved Britain can't actually do without them. And I think that's one absolutely salient fact from this crisis. I mean, whether they will be paid more is another matter. I think, yes, and we do massively undervalue the work and what these people contribute to our economy. You know, we don't need actually people shuffling bits of paper around in investment banks as much as we need someone to come and empty our bins or to look after our granddad or grandma in their home. So it certainly should, and I hope it does, but whether it will or not, that's the great imponderable.
Larry Elliott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Thank you, as ever, for your kind reviews. Do keep them coming. Thanks also to Larry Elliott and Mohamed Lajassa. This episode was produced by Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.